the air and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are number 040147, Teresa Marshall versus Housing Authority of the City of San Antonio from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Justice Green is not sitting in that case. Docket number 040460, the State of Texas and the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department versus Ricky Schumach and others from Blanco County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. And docket number 040575, Columbia Medical Center of Las Colinas, Inc. versus Athena Hogue and others from Dallas County and the 5th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in these matters. The court will take a brief recess between each argument. We expect to conclude all arguments before noon. These proceedings are being recorded digitally. A link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day. We are pleased to recognize our newest colleague, Bill Johnson of Amarillo, who was sworn in yesterday afternoon. The court is ready to hear argument in 040147, Teresa Marshall versus Housing Authority of the City of San Antonio.
May it please the court, Mr. Fred Fuchs will present argument to petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The principal issue before this court in Teresa Marshall's right to obtain appellate review of the judgment of possession in an eviction case, although she gave up possession because she was unable to post the supersedious bond, but the judgment has continuing effects for her beyond the mere loss of the apartment. I will first give the procedural posture of the case, second, identify the four issues I will address, and third, discuss each issue in turn. Turning first to the procedural posture of the case.
Can I ask just a factual background question? How much was she paying per month?
The contract rent on the unit, Your Honor, was $655. Her share of the rent based on her income in the calculation under the Section 8 program was zero. She was responsible for paying her own electricity for the unit.
So she paid nothing in rent?
She paid nothing to the landlord, the San Antonio Housing Authority. She paid her own electricity bill. Turning back to the procedural posture, Ms. Marshall had a Section 8 voucher issued through the San Antonio Housing Authority. Following a serious incident at her apartment in which there was a shooting, the San Antonio Housing Authority filed an eviction against her in justice court. She lost in justice court, appealed to the county court at law.
Does the eviction prevent her from getting future federal subsidies for housing?
Yes, it will, Your Honor. If one holds a voucher and one is evicted from housing, with the help of that voucher, then one can be denied any other federal housing assistance for a period of 5 years, not only another voucher, but public housing and project-based Section 8 housing.
Is that automatic, or is there a hearing to make that determination?
It depends on the type of housing she applies for, Your Honor. If she would apply, for example, for another voucher with a housing authority and she were denied on the basis that she had been evicted, then she would be entitled to a hearing on the basis of that denial.
Has she made that application?
No, Your Honor. She has not applied for other housing. If she applies, on the other hand, for project-based Section 8 housing, which is managed by privately owned, federally subsidized landlords, and she's denied, she's entitled to a meeting, not a hearing, but a meeting with the supervisor. In this case, the trial court entered judgment against her not only for possession, but for court costs and post-judgment interest.
What were the court costs?
The court costs in this case, as best as I can tell, Your Honor, were, I believe, $307. The Court of Appeals dismissed the appeal for want of jurisdiction, ruling the case was moot because Ms. Marshall had vacated the premises. That judgment is erroneous. Here is the background with respect to the supersedious. The trial court set the supersedious in the amount of $8,800. Ms. Marshall was financially...
What was the basis for that?
The trial court based that It's my understanding, Your Honor, on rents likely to accrue at the fair market value of the premises for a period of 1 year. I think the trial court assumed that the fair market rent would actually be about $755 and assumed that appeal would take about 12 months. Ms. Marshall, who had an income of $270 a month in temporary aid to needy families, was unable to post the $8,800 supersedious bond. She asked the Court of Appeals to review whether the bond was excessive. It denied her motion, and then she moved before the writ was executed. She moved for several reasons. She did not want to have herself and her children forcibly removed from the premises. She did not want to have her property set out in the street. She wanted to avoid the humiliation and embarrassment of being forcibly removed from the apartment.
If the appeal were moved, would Ms. Marshall have a remedy? Could she sue for wrongful eviction or appeal in any other way?
The judgment in an eviction case on possession is not res judicata or collateral estoppel. But it's not sufficient to say that she could sue for wrongful eviction for a number of reasons. One, it changes the burden of proof. The burden shifts from a landlord proving a violation to the tenant having to prove that the eviction was wrongful. Two, this court in our Communications versus Sharp was confronted with a similar argument by the state, where the state argued that the taxpayer had another remedy available in addition to suing for declaratory relief, and that remedy in that case was simply to wait on a collection suit. And this court in the Sharp case held that wasn't sufficient to overcome the financial barrier to access to the courts. Here, the 4 points I intend to address are as follows. First, the case is not moot because Ms. Marshall vacated the apartment under duress. She's not acquiesced in the judgment. A favorable ruling on the merits will substantially affect her rights. Second, the judgment has direct consequences for her beyond mere dispossession from the apartment.
Well, let me ask you about the direct consequences piece. Do we have any record problem with that? I mean, or does the other side stipulate that she will, in fact, lose housing assistance?
She did lose housing assistance, Your Honor, as a result of the eviction.
But is that's in the record? We don't have any problem with that?
There's nothing per se in the record, but it was consequences that flowed in this particular case. The San Antonio Housing Authority had not only issued the voucher, it was also the landlord, somewhat unusual under the Section 8 program. And when it evicted her, it did not issue her a voucher to move elsewhere. And there's an affidavit by her counsel under tab 5 of the reply brief stating that she moved from the premises to avoid the humiliation of another move. Here, the housing authority had no incentive because it was the one evicting her to give her a voucher to move elsewhere. The third point here, the reason the case is not moot, is that a favorable ruling on the merits would relieve Ms. Marshall of liability for the court cause. And finally, under this court's precedent, the right to obtain appellate review cannot be conditioned on satisfaction of a financial requirement. With respect to our federal constitutional claims, I'll simply refer the court to our brief at pages 22 and 23. The legislature enacted section 24.007 of the Texas Property Code behind tab 7 of the brief in 1983, and it became effective January 1, 1984. It provides for appeals of the issue of possession in eviction cases only if the premises are being used for residential purposes. It further provides, however, that a judgment of eviction may be stayed only if the appellant files a supersedious. It does not require the filing of a supersedious in order to proceed with an appeal, yet that is the effect of the ruling of the Court of Appeals. Here, Ms. Marshall moved under duress to avoid forcible removal of her family and her property. This court has consistently held that an appeal is not moot when a party satisfies a judgment under duress.
Well, what happens if you win your appeal?
If we win the appeal, then this case would be remanded to the Court of Appeals. is court asking what would happen if we obtained a favorable ruling from the Court of Appeals?
Yes, if she's not contesting possession, then what's left?
If we obtain the favorable ruling on the merits from the Court of Appeals, there would be two direct consequences to the client. One, she would be entitled to get a voucher back. And if the housing authority would not issue her a voucher on some pretense, then she would be entitled to sue to get that voucher because there would be no eviction
on
her record.
Yes, but I guess what I'm saying is, what would the judgment say? The judgment would say possession was wrongfully wrested from her?
I think that the judgment would simply say that the possession, that she's entitled to possession.
Well, but isn't that the problem? I mean,
here, Your Honor, she isn't seeking possession of the apartment
but
anymore.
But the judgment would say she's entitled.
Entitled to possession. And she would use that then to say, I'm entitled to a voucher because I should not have been evicted. And beyond that, I can no longer be denied federal housing assistance for a period of 5 years because the eviction has disappeared.
But under that judgment, couldn't she then, I mean, I understand you saying she doesn't want to use it to obtain possession. She merely wants it to get housing assistance. But couldn't she, under the judgment you'd be requesting, go back to that landlord and say, put me back in the premises?
Certainly, if one applied the same principles that one applies to a money credit, to a money creditor who executes on a money judgment, and then the debtor wins, the debtor would be able to seek satisfaction back from the money creditor. Here, if she gets possession of the apartment and the court finds that she was entitled to possession, then she could certainly ask for that. As a practical matter, though, that's not something that we're seeking in this case.
Well, let's get into practicalities then. What judgment short of a judgment granting her possession would give you the remedy the wrong that you're seeking to right?
The only judgment that can be entered is a judgment for her for possession. That would then remove the consequences of the eviction and allow her to obtain another voucher.
But she doesn't really want possession, so really it'd just be a declaratory judgment.
It'd be
a declaratory judgment that she should have won.
And that would have concrete offense for her, Your Honor.
I understand, but it wouldn't be any different from the wrongful eviction, a declaratory judgment and wrongful eviction suit.
It would be very different because in order to do that in a wrongful eviction suit, she has to actually file another suit. She assumes the burden of proof, and she would in wrongful eviction suit, you're limited to recovering damages. Here, what she has to gain by a favorable ruling on the merits is that voucher and the removal of the stigma that keeps her from getting other federal housing assistance, either a voucher or public housing.
Well, she hasn't applied for other federal assistance, nor has had a hearing to determine whether or not she can get additional vouchers. Why is this ripe for us to hear this now?
Because, Your Honor, it is currently a bar that exists against her, even if she hasn't applied. If she does apply, she will be denied that housing.
But the judgment's not going to give her that certificate. You don't think that?
Your Honor, I believe that the judgment would entitle her to do that.
In the judgment itself.
I agree with the court. The judgment wouldn't say that, but the practical effect would be that she could go to the housing authority and say, I prevailed. There wasn't an eviction in this case of me. I'm entitled to get my voucher back.
The problem I'm struggling with, though, is if the judgment is actually going to say possession, she is entitled to possession, then doesn't that undermine the whole purpose of the FED statute to make a quick resolution of possession that, I mean, doesn't it sort of turn the whole system on its head?
The response to that, Your Honor, is that the FED statute is very expedited through the Justice and the County Courts. There's no provision provided for expedited review once it hits the Court of Appeals. And the legislature recognized the right to appeal in Section 24.007, but said that if you wish to retain possession, you have to post a bond. It didn't say that in order to get appeal, one has to post the supersedious
bond. But that's
bond.
What our rule says that, doesn't it? Rule 749?
Well, Rule 749, Your Honor, applies only to appeals from justice court to county court. And it is a similar situation in that if a tenant appeals from justice court to county court and wishes to remain in possession, the tenant has to and files an affidavit of inability to pay the court costs. To remain in possession in a non-payment of rent case, the tenant has to pay rent into the court registry. If it's not a non-payment of rent case, the tenant can simply proceed on the affidavit. But this court held in the Blue Water Gardens Apartments case that payment of rent acts as a supersedious. And in another case out of the Court of Appeals in Dallas, the Kennedy versus Highland Hills case, the Court of Appeals there, when a landlord had obtained a judgment on the merits because the tenant had failed to pay the rent into the court registry, the Dallas Court of Appeals said all that did was entitle the landlord to obtain possession. It did not entitle the landlord to obtain a finding on the merits of the case.
Well, but in this case, if you prevail in the Court of Appeals, all the judgment is going to say is that the housing authority take nothing, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you're not seeking any further relief after that. And you can't, really.
The relief we're seeking, Your Honor, then, is to the removal of the effects of that judgment. And that would be we would go to the housing authority and say, we've prevailed. She's entitled to get back her voucher.
You didn't really prevail. You just didn't lose.
Well, we didn't lose, but that would be the same as that would be the same as prevailing for purposes.
Can't they take the position that you had a shooting at your apartment, so we're not going to give you another voucher?
Well, but they terminated here because there was the eviction. She'll be entitled once that eviction is removed from her record to get another voucher. Here,
would your position be different if she were actually seeking possession?
No, Your Honor, it would not, because here that would give an additional element keeping the case alive. But because of the consequences that flowed from her here, regardless of whether she's seeking possession or whether she's simply seeking to remove the direct consequences of the eviction from her record, the result, it seems to me, would be the same.
Assuming the judgment could be superseded, what does we have a brief from an amicus, an apartment association. What would landlords have to do? Do they have to keep that apartment vacant during the pendency of the appeal, or do they advise any tenant that they're renting to that, you know, this may be a short duration? It just depends on when the appeal is resolved.
No, Your Honor, I don't think they have to do that at all. And if in a particular case, and this is not the particular case, but if a tenant wanted to regain possession in a particular case, and this would really only occur in public housing cases and federally assisted housing, because in most cases the lease will have expired and the landlord could have subsequently terminate the lease. But if a tenant wanted to obtain possession, then thank you.
Continue your
thought. If the tenant wanted to obtain possession, then as a practical matter in our society today with large apartment complexes, the landlord can make available the next available apartment to the tenant. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. David Frischies will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. First, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, I want to thank the court's indulgence, counsel, for the petitioner's indulgence and Mr. Weber's indulgence in changing the date of my oral submission.
Have a good trip.
Thank you. And my wife appreciates it, Your Honor. This case turns on two issues. First of all, we have to look at the judicial intent of this court in promulgating Rule 746 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. 746 is a codification of the old revised civil statute 3984, which establishes that there is one issue and one issue alone in a forcible detainer action. That rule along with other rules and statutes that were passed by the Texas legislature, create a scheme of handling forcible detainer actions as an ancillary proceeding in the Justice of the Peace Courts, and establish what has been called a speedy, simple, and effective remedy for landlords. The second issue that
How did she ever get her costs back?
I'm sorry?
How would she ever get out from underneath the judgment of costs against her?
She could pay the costs.
Well, what if she doesn't owe them and she wants to appeal the fact that they've been adjudged against her?
She could file a supersedious bond and comply with Rule 24.007 and 24.2 of this court.
So even if possession is not an issue, you can see that if she filed a bond to cover the costs, she could go forward with her appeal. Or if she filed an affidavit of indigency, she could go forward with the appeal of the cost.
Well, there, under the Lovelace case, Your Honor, an indigent still has to file a supersedious bond in order to appeal. And then when you look at 24.2, the rule of appellate procedure 24.2 of this court, in order to recover real property.
Let's assume she's not trying to get possession. All she wants to do is get this judgment erased off her record and get the eviction expunged, basically.
I think she could file a supersedious bond.
For how much?
In order to cover the court costs, the $355 or the $345 plus the amount of any prejudgment interest that it accrued.
Did you all insist on the $8,000 court bond?
Your Honor, we did put on evidence, and if the court looks at the record, and the order issued by Judge Crouch, there was a hearing on the merits with regard to what the fair market value of rent would be during the pendency of appeal pursuant to 24.007.
Right. But your client was the owner.
Was the owner.
And was subsidizing her rent 100%.
HUD was subsidizing, and she had a voucher that was issued through the housing authority. Yes, Your Honor.
So it wouldn't have been any different if on appeal she hadn't been in paying anything. She hadn't been paying anything before.
She hadn't been.
So why'd you insist on $8,000 for a bond if she wasn't paying you anything before? You weren't out that much.
Because the events under this particular lease resulted in a termination of her housing assistance. This was not a HUD lease. This was actually a Texas Apartment Association lease, which has a specific provision in paragraph 20 that says that the conduct of this resident and the resident's guests cannot disturb the rights, comfort, health, safety, and conveniences of others in or near the apartment community. The effect of the act of this person's guest was to terminate her right.
I know, you assume you're going to win, but you really didn't lose $8,000 if this lady stayed there. You hadn't lost $8,000 for the year she'd been there, however long, right?
Your Honor, we have to remember, however, that street rent for this property was approximately $750, and the Housing Authority does not have to lease every unit to a Section 8 voucher holder. This unit was going to remain perhaps...
But the fact of the matter is, you make a lot more money from this lady on the supersedious bond than you ever made from her in actual rent.
If we could enforce it, yes, Your Honor.
Help me with the timing here. When did she give up physically in the appeal process? When did she physically give up possession?
Apparently after it was appealed to the Fourth Court of Appeals. We don't have a specific time that's part of the record. In fact, there are 12 citations in the petitioner's brief to the fact that she was she left under duress, she left before the writ of possession issued. There are 12 allegations of fact that are not supported by the record. In the petitioner's brief. So, you know, at some point during the appeal process, she did vacate, and the affidavit that's part of the record indicated she left the state.
You agree that the eviction compromises her right to obtain a future voucher?
I do, Your Honor.
And that doesn't make the appeal not moot?
Well, interestingly, Your Honor, if the court reviews page 6 of the petitioner's brief, one of the statements they say is, under Texas law, when an appellate court concludes that a case is moot, as Justice Green did at the Fourth Court of Appeals, all orders entered in the cause by the lower courts are set aside, including the original judgment. Now, under that reasoning, what Mr. Fuchs is requesting before this court today seems to me to be exactly what they want. The fact that if the original judgment is set aside, Ms. Marshall may be able to go request her voucher just because the Fourth Court says it was moot.
that's not what happened.
That's not what happened.
So did the Court of Appeals err in not rendering that judgment?
No, Your Honor. I do not believe that the Court of Appeals erred.
Instead of dismissing it for want of jurisdiction, your theory would be the Court of Appeals should have vacated the judgment below and dismissed the case as moot.
Well, I believe that the Court of Appeals was correct in dismissing the case as moot because of the loss of possession.
But is that what it did, or did it just dismiss the appeal for want of jurisdiction?
It dismissed the appeal for want of jurisdiction only.
So it didn't set aside?
It did not set aside.
But you think it should have?
Well, I was just quoting out of petitioner's brief, Your Honor. Their position is that a dismissal as moot, in fact, sets aside the original judgment, which is apparently what one of the issues that the petitioner is requesting, so that this person could potentially go back and request another voucher.
Well, the judgment's not vacated.
I understand.
She still owes a court cost. So how is it that she can get her court costs back once she gives up possession, but she still says, I was wrongfully evicted. I'm not trying to get possession. I want my court costs back. What should she have done here?
The only thing I could say, Your Honor, is that she would need to comply with 24.2 and file a supersedious bond to supersede that judgment to proceed with the appeal.
The $307.
Yes.
What is the practical harm of allowing the appeal? What is the practical harm of allowing the appeal?
Your Honor, one of the issues here is what happens with this landlord and the unit. Is the unit supposed to remain vacant?
No.
I agree.
It's like if a judgment creditor goes and executes, he does it at his risk. And if he takes the car or whatever there is, sells it, the debtor, if he prevails on appeal, can't go get it back. It's gone. But he may get a judgment against the creditor for seizing it, which you agree, I take it, that the tenant could do through a wrongful eviction.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So I'm just wondering what the practical consequence of it is.
Well, we have to go back, and I think this court actually has to, instead of looking at legislative history, look at judicial intent in promulgating the rules regarding forcible detainers. Did this court intend for there to be a speedy, inexpensive, and summary procedure beginning with Rule 746?
When you get an appeal, it's not summary in the sense that you don't have no right of appeal.
No, I understand that.
So what's the harm in allowing someone to appeal a money judgment against him of $307?
Well, in our brief, Your Honor, we believe that's addressed by the doctrine of de minimis.
Well, that's not de minimis to a lot of folks. That's why we have JP courts, and that's why we have appeals.
But when it's coupled with the suit for possession and the sole...
That's dropped out of the case. That's $307 is real money to a lot of people, and they have a right of appeal.
I understand, Your Honor. But our position is in a forcible detainer action, when they have other remedies that are available to them, like a suit for wrongful eviction or some other action, because the forcible detainer rules are cumulative under 24.008, it doesn't stop an action for any other basis.
By the same token, it doesn't say that you were limited in your FE&DC. Our rules of procedure allow you to get damages and costs.
Damages and costs only.
And all we're talking about here now at this point are costs.
I agree.
So where in the statute says you can't appeal the rendition of costs?
I don't think the statute says that, Your Honor. I think what we're saying is because it is coupled with a suit for possession, and it is only coupled with a suit for possession.
So once that goes away, you're tagged with costs no matter what?
That's our position, Your Honor. That's our position. Because this forcible detainer, the set of procedures, if you look at the rules for forcible detainer, they couple with 24.008 of the property code, 24.007 of the property code, 8 being the fact that it's a cumulative remedy and doesn't prevent any other remedies. It also specifically, 24.007, the one that we're on here today, says that a supersedious bond, like 24.2 of the rules of this court, is required to be posted in order to supersede the judgment.
Well, does it come down to this thing, that the practical consequence is that the parties are going to have to go through an appeal over essentially court costs?
Yes, Your Honor.
Otherwise, the possession, lives move along, the rights and remedies are the same, everybody's basically in the same position. So we've got an appeal, and the legal issue is, was the judgment on possession act, was it correct?
Was it correct?
And the consequences are the court costs.
That is correct. And in this case, Your Honor, the Housing Authority waived the attorney's fees. They did not seek attorney's fees at the time they were seeking possession. The judgment for attorney's fees is zero. Judgment for rent is zero.
Would the case be different if there were an award of attorney fees?
Your Honor, our position is, again, because it's coupled with this unique suit for possession under Rule 746, it would not be different. Now,
so if she gotten $20,000 worth of attorney's fees assessed against her, and she voluntarily vacated the premises, she would not have the right to appeal the $20,000 judgment against her?
I think she would, Your Honor. I think she would.
Then why doesn't she have the right to appeal the $307?
Again, under the doctrine of non curat lex, about the de minimis amount when it is cut, this court has to make some determination as to when an appeal.
We have statutes on the books that allow you to appeal if the amount in controversy is at $100 or more. That's a legislative.
I understand. And again, my position is because it's coupled with this forcible detainer procedure, which is unique in Texas, that she should not be able to appeal that. Now, with regard to... Unique to Texas.
Other states have similar procedures.
Well, I don't know that other states have the speedy, effective procedures that we have in Texas. I mean, Texas has... Because of the coupling between 746, 742, 747A with the property code 24.007 and 24.008, it is a unique procedure, I think, from the cases that I have seen. It's a very unique procedure for evictions, and because it turns on the sole issue of possession back on 746. An eviction case only is and turns on the issue of possession. If that issue of possession goes away, there should be no eviction case. Now, with regard to the petitioner's argument with regard to the open courts doctrine, the case cited under the open courts doctrine, Dillingham versus Putnam, only dealt with a statute for a receiver to post bond in order to effect an appeal. This court recognized in Dillingham that with regard to a receivership, the receiver actually does not have possession or ownership of personal property or real property in order to post a supersedious bond. So when you look at Dillingham versus Putnam and apply it to this case, they're two different animals. Dillingham dealt with a specific statutory procedure whereby a receiver did not actually own property but would have to get court approval to dispose of any property. And in that case, the Dillingham case, this court struck down that particular statute as unconstitutional. Now, what's interesting about 24.007, the statute that we're arguing about here, is it does not require that the court assess a bond for rent. It says that the court may assess a bond for rent. It is not a mandatory requirement incumbent upon the county court to establish the payment of rent in the bond.
Counsel, all that supersedious does, though, is allow the person to stay in possession. Is that correct? Pending the appeal.
That is correct.
What effect does it have on you and your client to come on appeal to determine the propriety of the initial determination that she's not entitled to possession? How does it affect you, other than you come up here and you try to find out on that?
Well, the first...
You've got the possession. You can go ahead and rent it. And if that's wrongful, she can recover in damages later.
Well, primarily, Your Honor, we have to rely potentially on collecting under the bond as opposed to a typical tenant that resides there that is paying rent on a monthly basis.
But in this case, you have possession. You can rent it.
We can.
You're not out any money.
That is correct.
What harm to your client to allow an appeal to determine the propriety of that eviction under this the right of possession? There was a determination. What harm to you to allow that to be appealed?
Well, the question is, can you give effective relief on appeal? What could this court do? Would the court award possession back to the tenant at some point in the future? And then you have the quandary of, does that apartment unit or that specific unit have to be provided since the lawsuit was based on a specific apartment unit or a specific single family home? Do you have to remove the person who is currently renting there and put the tenant back into possession?
I understand we have a question about remedy. My question to you is, what harm has your client suffered if, in fact, we allow an appeal to determine the propriety of possession? Now, there's a question on remedy. I understand that. But what harm have you suffered? You got the property. You rented it. You've got what you need. You have an immediate determination of the right of possession. You prevailed. You've got the property. Now, what harm other than that? Now, we may have to craft a remedy, but that's a different question.
Well, the uncertainty of what the result of the appeal is going to bring and force upon the landlord. I mean,
isn't that a question for a wrongful eviction suit?
I would think so, Your Honor. That landlord should not be subject to the potential of having to put that person back into possession of that particular unit. And the uncertainty is, what if it's a single family homeowner with one unit, and the person vacates during the pendency of the appeal, then appeals and is returned to possession, the landlord is in a between a rock and a hard place with regard to the existing tenant. Now, I would agree with the court that they don't lose rent, they don't lose utilities or anything else that is due under the terms of the lease. And in fact, they may have a duty at some point in the process to mitigate their damages by reducing the amount of the supersedious bond if, in fact, there has been payment of rent during the pendency of the appeal.
Let me ask you, we haven't spoken much about the collateral consequences doctrine. I know that you rely on Kemper in your briefing, but none of the tenants there alleged that they would suffer any collateral consequences. We held in Correa versus State that a juvenile, for example, who was adjudicated delinquent and had served their time, still had a stigma or collateral consequences attached to that would keep it from being moved. Why is this any different?
All of the stigma cases, Your Honor, deal with juvenile delinquency, a criminal situation, contempt for child support violations, family violence orders, and that sort of thing. This court has never extended the stigma in collateral.
The reasoning would be the same, wouldn't it, that there's a stigma about being adjudicated delinquent? There's a stigma as well about being evicted from your apartment complex that has very real, perhaps more tangible consequences than in those contexts. Why shouldn't we extend it here?
Well, I can see that the stigma is there, but there is also the stigma of the fact that this person had a shooting occur in her unit between two of her guests. One of her guests shot another. In this particular case, I'm not sure that the stigma that attaches with regard to an eviction.
Let me not say stigma, because that's a bit of an intangible term. Let's talk about collateral consequences, the very real loss of voucher assistance. Why would that not be enough to save this from movement?
There are thousands and thousands of people on waiting lists for vouchers in the state of Texas. There are thousands of people who are willing to reside in public housing and low-income housing and affordable housing who are willing to follow the rules. In this case, in Rucker, I think HUD versus Rucker is very instructive. It's a unanimous United States Supreme Court opinion, 8-0, determined in record time, where Pearlie Rucker was held to be evicted because she was an innocent tenant.
But that case was not dismissed as moot.
It was not dismissed as moot.
The merits of the appeal were addressed.
I agree.
So that would work against.
But in that case, it was an innocent tenant defense that was raised by Pearlie. Teresa Marshall raised an innocent tenant defense, and I think the collateral consequences are outweighed by the public policy of providing homes.
Which goes to the merits, but not mootness.
Which, yes. All right.
If Ms. Marshall had been physically evicted rather than voluntarily relinquishing possession, would your answer to the mootness question change?
No, it would not. The eight cases that we cite and are cited by petitioner all deal with situations where possession was delivered both before and after a writ of possession was served. And I think when you couple that with 24.007 of the property code, once the writ of possession is served, it is also moot.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
And I thank this honorable report.
Please, the court again.
Counsel, following up on some dialogue we had with your opposition, the ordinary rule is that if a case becomes moot while it's on appeal, the judgments below are vacated and the case is dismissed, not just the court of appeals dismisses the appeal, the one of jurisdiction. You see that difference? Why wouldn't that give your client all that she wants in this case?
That is a very interesting point, Your Honor, and I think there are two responses on that. First, in State of Texas versus Lodge, that argument was made by the dissent, and the majority there said that a favorable ruling on the merits would not be the same as a finding that the case was moot and the vacation of all of the lower court orders. If the courts decided that that's the consequence and that all lower court orders are indeed vacated and of no effect, that would have to be clear in this court's order, in this court's opinion. Otherwise, you'll still have parties saying that there was an eviction, it was just dismissed as moot.
But does it give your client any less than she wants by going through the appeal? Because you can understand there would be some reluctance to have the Court of Appeals in a complex eviction case have to go through all of the analysis of the legal rights that are being asserted if the only issue is going to be court costs.
Well, if we apply the logic again of State of Texas versus Lodge, the court there again held that the court's finding that the case is moot is not the same as a favorable ruling on the merits of the case. Here, if we require a supersedious in order for a tenant to obtain appellate review, then we are creating a system where those who have the money can obtain appellate review. Those who are poor will not be able to obtain appellate review.
Well, do you have a point in this court complaining about the Court of Appeals' refusal to reduce the $8,000 bond? You're not complaining about that anymore.
No, we're not complaining about the amount of the bond. That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, shouldn't before we declare the statute unconstitutional because of the bond, shouldn't you have to complain of it?
Your Honor, we're not seeking a declaration that 24007 is unconstitutional. We're saying the statute is perfectly constitutional. We're saying that you can still obtain the right of review even if you do not post a supersedious bond. The statute does not require posting a supersedious.
Well, what would we do in a case where the dispute was over land or stock or something, and after it was over, the defendant, the judgment debtor said, okay, I give up. Here's what you want. But I want to clear my good name because I think I was right after all, and I want an appeal, and I don't want to pay the court costs. Wouldn't we dismiss that as moot?
That's a different case because there's a voluntary acquiescence then in the judgment, and there aren't the collateral direct consequences as in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the court will now take a brief recess.
All right.